John Bunyan's classic work, Pilgrim's Progress, he described a Vanity Fair where all of life's pleasures and distractions were on display, and his friend and companion, Faithful, lost his life for not joining in the fair. And then we have a magazine called Vanity Fair, a magazine that started in the late 1800s and then died before being resurrected in the 80s, a magazine that focuses on life's vanities, on what the social and economic elite can do with their power and their influence and their money, what's trending in culture. And many of us may see the name of the magazine compared to what is described in John Bunyan's book and shake our heads that the magazine can be so on the nose. But you know what killed that magazine the first time? The Great Depression. For all of its influence and power, when no one had any money for anything extra, when there was no upper social class, there was no one to buy that magazine focused on life's vanities. And it failed. Only to come again when more money and more wealth was available in the 80s. We might shake our heads that people would spend their money and their time and effort and attention on something so overtly taken up with what is ultimately vanity. Now, let's stop for a second and define what is vanity. We use that word and we may have certain connotations with it, but there's two basic definitions. One, excessive pride in or admiration of one's own appearance or achievements. Number two, the quality of being worthless or futile. And we might shake our head at the vanity of Vanity Fair. But lest we feel self-righteous, the call this morning to us is to see our own tendency to fall into vanity. To give too much credit to our own achievements, to give too much value to what is ultimately worthless or futile. As Christians, we may avoid or seek to avoid the many vanities described in Bunyan's book or even in the magazine, but that doesn't mean that we don't fall prey to vanity. That is what the churches in the region of Galatia are doing. That is what we as Christians are often tempted to do when we focus on our religiosity. When we focus on the practice of our religion. When our primary focus is on the creation and fulfillment of rules and rituals that serve as our primary sense of worth and self-definition. We, like the churches in Galatia, can be tempted to the vanity of legalism, to the vanity of being religious. Let me just comment that religion gets a bad name, and what we're not talking against this morning is organized religion, what we do around the heart and center of worshiping God, but we are talking about the things around the edges and the organization itself becoming what is worshiped. And so we'll talk a lot about how legalism and being religious really end up being the same thing. And Paul is concerned that this is what is happening to the churches in Galatia. In verse 11, he says, "I am afraid I may have labored over you in vain." Because they are turning to the religious observances of the Old Testament system, and in so doing, they are taking up legalism. They are enslaving themselves again to religiosity. They went from one form of religiosity, paganism, to another form of religiosity in performing the rituals and rites of the Old Testament sacrificial system. And Paul is unwilling to let the churches wander off the path unwarned, to put their weight on something that will not hold them, to put their trust in vanity. This passage marks a transition as Paul has been exhorting and encouraging to remember what they received in the gospel of Christ. And now he is exhorting them to not fall prey. His message is to hold on to God in Christ. You have come to know God. You have come to be known by God. Do not be enslaved to the vanity of being religious. Turn back from the vanity of legalism. If we are going to engage what Paul has to say this morning, I think we need to first acknowledge how easy this is to fall prey to. It is not so much the obvious dangers that we fall into, it is the dangers that are less obvious or the most tempting. And let's be real, we just shared a number of difficult, painful prayer requests, did we not? Disease, loss, financial things, things that we feel tangibly, things that we need, things that we hope for. And the wonderful thing about religion, the wonderful thing about legalism, is it gives us something to do in response to life's difficulties. That religion and legalism can shroud themselves in the veil, not of vanity, but in purposeful response to a broken world. And so if you're sitting here this morning saying, I'm a good Christian, I'm not prone to religion, I'm a good Christian, I'm not prone to legalism, let me ask you if you are taking seriously the draw of this world and its problems, and you are over-trusting your ability not to respond to them. If it was so obvious, if it was so easy, then the letter of Galatians wouldn't need to be written. If it was so easy, then the Pharisees would have welcomed the coming of Jesus with open arms and joyful celebration instead of railing against him. So let us take the warning of this passage serious. Let us cooperate as God uses Paul to unmask the vanity of being religious. First, as we see the emptiness of being religious. Remember, one of the definitions of vanity is the quality of being worthless or futile, and we will come to see that being religious is empty. That's not how we tend to think of religion, though, is it? To be religious is not to be empty, but full. It's full of rituals. Our calendar may be full of religious things to do. Requirements, habits, practices, beliefs that we have to know, facts. But busyness is not fullness, and activity is not equivalent to contentment. And Paul, in this passage, to confront the emptiness of being religious, does something astounding for a Jew and a former Pharisee. He compares the Old Testament system of laws and rituals with pagan idolatry. This is a Jew who has grown up, a Jew among Jews, who has the Old Testament and all of its sacrificial requirements memorized by heart, who has lived them to the nth degree most of his life until Christ appeared. And he is comparing all of that to going to the local temple and bowing down before Athena, or a statue of a god or goddess that may or may not have engaged in all kinds of otherwise immoral things that they have entrusted themselves to. He reminds them first of their pagan background in verse 8. Formerly, when you did not know God, you were enslaved to those that by nature are not gods. Paul is reminding them, before you received the gospel, you were religious. You had rituals, you had practices in relationship to your worship of those that were not gods. You were religious before, and all of your religious devotion was given over in an enslavement to gods that did not exist, to gods that are really not gods. 1 Corinthians 8, 4-5 describes this in different language. It says, therefore, as to the eating of food offered to idols, we know that an idol has no real existence. and that there is no God but one. For although there may be so-called gods in heaven or earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet there is for us only one God, the Father, from whom all things and for whom things exist. And the thing is, they realize this. Paul comes and he preaches the gospel to them, and they receive the gospel that these are idols are not really gods, that the worship of these idols is empty and does not provide for them real hope. And our passage shows us that they received Paul's message with gladness and joy, and they received him as an angel or even Christ himself. But the implication of verse 9 is that they are going to repeat the mistake of their idolatry by going to the Old Testament law. But now that you have come to know God, or rather to be known by God, how can you turn back again to weak and worthless elementary principles of the world, whose slaves you want to be once more? Let me be clear. Paul is not saying that the churches in Galatia are going back to serve Roman and Greek and regional gods. He is saying by taking up the Old Testament sacrificial system, by what verse 10 says, your observance of days and months and seasons and years, these specifically Jewish holidays and days of Sabbath and days of feasting and days of fasting, if you are taking these on to yourselves, it is the same as going back again to the emptiness of worshiping idols. They are both elementary principles. They are both, as he describes here, weak and worthless, because they are not about the true God. Paganism, because it worships gods that are not gods. The Old Testament religious system, because the system was to be a signpost to the real God. And now that he has shown himself in Jesus Christ, they are holding on to the signposts instead of the thing that they point to. Hebrews 8:5 explicitly tells us that the tabernacle and the sacrificial system was a shadow of the real and heavenly. They have the real thing in Jesus Christ. They have come to know God and be known by God, and they are holding on to the shadow instead of the real one who cast that shadow. Christ has come. They have come to know God, and this is interesting that Paul makes it very clear, or rather to be known by God, just in case they are tempted to say, hey, we're following these rituals, we've been good people, so we get to know God as if we've earned him. He makes it clear by flipping the switch and saying, not only do you know God, but it's because God has known you. Now that that has happened, and as he's been telling them, they have received Jesus. They've received the Spirit of Jesus. They've received the Spirit of adoption that has been powerful among them, that has testified that they are sons of the living King. How can you replace the real with the empty? That's why he says at the end of the passage, I am perplexed about you. They are exchanging the weightiness and substance of the true and living God for empty formalism, just as empty as the marble statues that dotted the landscape around them. Whatever does not draw us into deeper relationship with the real God, whatever draws our attention to itself instead of the living God, is empty and vain. This is the God who made all things and from whom all things come and for whom all things exist. He is the source of all. Why would we be content with what merely flows from him? Man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. Religion is supposed to be organized around the worship and glorification of God. But if religion comes to delight in ritual, if it comes to delight in laws, then it comes to glorify in what man achieves. And thus it's empty. I have a lot of friends on Facebook, and I don't have a lot compared to other people, but I do have a number of friends. And when they travel, they like to post their travel pictures. And it is very common when someone goes to a city, whether they're in the airport or they're driving into the city, they take a picture by the sign for the city, right? Let you know where they are. You know, welcome to New York City, welcome to Las Vegas, welcome to London, wherever it is. And you have this picture to remind them of their trip. What would it be like to page through their album and see every picture of their trip being them in front of that sign? And you start asking them about the trip, and you find out that their trip to London was a trip to the sign for London. That their trip to Boston was for the sign for Boston. It seems ridiculous to us. The sign is supposed to indicate that you've arrived in the destination. The sign is to say, come explore the riches of this city, its culture, its food, its monuments, its museums. Come and explore the reality. And it would be preposterous for someone to content themselves to just visit the sign. But so often, when we trust in our religious practice, when we are trusting in our keeping of the rules and the laws, whether worshiping false gods, whether trusting in Christian practice, or whether finding our enjoyment in just licentious living, we are contenting ourselves with the sign instead of the substance that it points to. What do you confuse for God? Who do you confuse for God? Is your confidence in your performance of religious duties, or is it in what Christ has done for you? Being religious is vain and empty because it leads us away from God instead of to Him. It's not only empty, it's powerless. Religiosity and legalism has a power to enslave us, but it is ultimately powerless to change us and transform us. In this passage, we see the difference between one's heart under the influence of the gospel versus one's heart under the influence of rule-keeping. In verses 12 to 15, it gives us a picture of Paul's first encounter among the people who came to make up the churches in Galatia. He says, in verse 13, you know it was a bodily ailment, and because of that, that I preached the gospel to you. So Paul is sick. He's not doing well. This may be the issue that he refers to elsewhere as the thorn in his side, and for whatever reason, goes to the region of Galatia and rests. And because he's there, uses that as an opportunity to preach the gospel. And let me say that many people guess that Paul's affliction was maybe blindness, and that's why it mentions taking their eyes out for him and why he talks about writing in such big letters. That's very possible, but also in the society, you know, what could be more loving and showing a friendship than taking your eyes and giving them to someone else? We talk about taking your shirt off your back for someone else, how much more precious your eyes. So we can't say for certain what his ailment was, but we know it was debilitating. We know that it was a trial for them to care for them. But as he preached the gospel on the occasion of his illness, they received him with warmth. They received him with love and care. They gave him honor and respect as if he was an angel or Jesus Christ. Those that they would have no reason to respect had they not received the gospel. And Paul makes it clear that his condition was a trial to them. And even though it was the case, they did not scorn or despise him. Let's be clear, this is the difference that Christianity has made in a culture, that we do not automatically despise and scorn someone that is sick, especially with a long illness. Because in that society, in that day and age, an ongoing illness was a sign of judgment from some god, or someone had cursed you, and if you suffered from something that was debilitating or deforming or disabling, you were to be avoided, you were to be shunned, you were to be put out of your misery if possible, not to be cared for. And as Paul has preached the gospel, It has changed the culture. It has changed their response to him in such a way that they not only heard the gospel and put up with him, but they cared for him and were willing to offer anything that they had for his sake and well-being. The gospel made him not a burden or an object of scorn, but an object of love. Compare that to verses 15 and 16. What then has become of the blessing you feel? Verse 16, have I then become your enemy by telling you the truth? Whereas before they had a state of blessing, now they have a state of mistrust. As they are beginning to take upon themselves the religious practices of the Jews so that they can feel certain that God loves them and accepts them because they're not sure that Christ is enough, they are beginning to mistrust Paul. Before they only had Christ crucified as their hope, they didn't have anything else but that preaching from Paul. And that hope changed them, but now they are falling prey to legalism's focus on the external instead of the heart. There is now mistrust and animosity. This is symptomatic of a life of being religious because it focuses on the outside instead of the heart. In Hebrews 9:9, as it describes the Old Testament system, it says, according to this arrangement, the gifts and the sacrifices offered could not perfect the conscience of the worshiper. That even though they were commanded and part of what God gave his people who were trusting in him and his promises, it is acknowledged that those things could never change their hearts, could never cleanse them of the sin within, could never make them pure and holy before God. But now because Paul does not live like a Jew, when among Gentiles they are suspicious of him. If he's a good Christian, why doesn't he keep the Jewish system? Thus his desire in verse 12 that they become like him. That is, he came and lived as a Gentile among them so that they could receive the good news of Jesus Christ. Why now are they becoming Jews instead of taking up Christ first and foremost to shape their identity? Whereas before their hearts were touched, now it's just what their eyes see that dictate their acceptance of something. This is the difference between being religious and the transformative nature of the gospel. When being religious or the law is what is predominant in our lives, we feel good when we do not sin. It is acceptable to not appear like we've messed up or to show forth what we have accomplished in fulfillment of what is required of us. The gospel is not content with formalist behaviorism. The gospel wants hearts on fire for God. The gospel comes and gives us hearts of flesh instead of hearts of stone. The gospel says, I am not content for you merely to not commit adultery or to not do debauched things. I want your heart to view the opposite sex with purity and for their sake. It is not sufficient to appear as a good businessman or businesswoman. I want your heart to shape all that you do in society and through your business for the glory of God and for the benefit of your neighbor. If being religious leads away from the glory of God and doesn't change our hearts but leaves us content with externalism, we will also not be surprised to find that it is vain because it lacks love. Being religious is a vanity because it is futile if it leads us away from the true God. It is vanity because it focuses on the externals instead of changing the heart. And it is empty and vain because it is ultimately loveless. Now let's be clear. Almost every religion commands love, doesn't it? Christianity is not unique in advocating that its followers love one another. We're not even unique in some of the calls to love those that are different from us. The various religions of the world share a command for love and a value of love. But without the real love of God changing our hearts by the working of His Spirit, our expression of that religion is ultimately without love, whatever is commanded of us. Because in the end, love becomes about an external expression rather than God-pleasing, heart-targeted love. And we see this in the comparison between Paul's stance toward the Galatians versus that of the Judaizers. Now, the Galatians may feel that the Judaizers are more loving because, as it tells us in verse 17, they are making much of the Galatians. And while Paul, he's confronting them. He's calling them out, and he is self-admittingly using a tone that might be uncomfortable for the Galatians to receive. And with the externalism of religiosity, it would seem that the Judaizers are more loving. They are saying good things about you. They are making you feel better about yourself. They are encouraging you. They are investing lots of time in you and shaping you and even discipling you in a certain way. Sounds pretty loving, doesn't it? But niceness and love are not the same thing. Religiosity contents itself with the tone of speech. If it sounds nice, then it is nice. If it looks good, then it is good. But the gospel produces love that has a concern not only for the tone, but also the content and motivation of the speech and the act. In the end, the Judaizers are not being loving. They are making much, as the passage tells us, so that they can be made much of. They are trying to woo the Galatians to their side, to shut them out from Paul and attract the Galatians to their point of view. The motivation of the Judaizers is their appearance, their strength, what benefits them. They are not breeding love, but division. They are not seeking the interest of the Galatians, but themselves. They are falling into flattery. And Proverbs 26:28 says, "A lying tongue hates its victims, and the flattering mouth works ruin." Paul, in contrast, has a harsh tone. But his motivation is not out of concern for appearances. His motivation is not out of concern for himself. It is gospel love that dies to self for the sake of another. What he wants more than anything else is to see Christ formed in them. In verse 19, he says, "My little children, for whom I am again in the anguish of childbirth until Christ is formed in you." What he wants is them to image Christ, to grow in the knowledge of Jesus Christ and live their lives like Jesus. And for that, he is in anguish, not just in anguish, but again in anguish. Someone that has a rule of religion that says you have to sacrifice for the sake of someone else might endure suffering for a while for the sake of someone else. Paul has already done that for this group. He's lived among them and preached the gospel and suffered alongside them already so that they would receive the gospel. And now that they are turning away, he does not wash his hands of them, but he's willing to suffer again for their sake. He is willing to anguish because that is what Christ did for him. It seeks the good of the other, even at the most profound cost to self. And love does seek the good of the other, is concerned for the other. Paul may be bold, Paul may be a bit harsh in his tone, but he doesn't want to be. Even as he is acknowledging it, he says, "This is because I can't be with you face to face. If I was face to face and I know how you were receiving this, I could ease my tone. I could be more gentle. But brothers and sisters, your danger is such that for your good, I have to be harsh." He expresses that, and the sorrow he has over having to be direct shows that what he's concerned about is them. Love is willing to challenge with the truth. Love is willing to pay the price for the sake of another, and this is what the gospel does. And love not only is willing to challenge, but is also willing to be challenged. Because love is compatible with the truth of the gospel. Why have they begun to mistreat Paul, to consider him an enemy? Because of his challenge to them with the truth. And they have forgotten that faithful are the wounds of a friend. Because legalism and religiosity don't care about the actual truth, but the appearance of truth. It ultimately doesn't care about whether someone is right, but whether they appear to be right. And so being religious means that people are less likely to confront with the truth for the sake of the other, lest it makes the other person look bad or in comparison opens themselves up to being challenged. Whereas if we have the love of Christ and are secure that we receive his righteousness, then we do not have to self-justify. Because we know we have the love of Christ and we can accept every challenge. We can offer every challenge out of love instead of viewing it as a threat to ourselves or to others. Without that, we will content ourselves with the appearance of love instead of its heart that seeks our good and seeks the good of one another. There's a way that I fall down in loving Rebecca sometimes that she's expressed to me a couple of times, and I just struggle with it because it's not the way that I'm wired. But she has overtly expressed to me that it is unkind and unloving to her if I do not tell her that something is in her teeth. She might have some spinach, she might have something stuck in her teeth. And on one hand, I'm just not observant. I fall into the typical male that way sometimes. But there are other times I do see it, and I don't take enough concern for her to risk the embarrassment of pointing it out, to risk the awkwardness. And my wife is showing her love and risking embarrassment for me to share this story with you this morning. Because she understands that to risk for her, to pay the price of awkwardness, shows that my concern is actually for her instead of my own comfort. And the gospel of Jesus Christ is that Jesus was not content to see his creation fall into sin and disrepair and its own destruction to say, well, they deserved it. But endured the pain and shame of the cross to challenge our idolatry and our vanity so that we could receive the good news of salvation. Can we be honest and say this is often where Christians fall down? That we often have a religious view of love instead of a gospel view of love. Well, we're the church, we're supposed to be happy. Well, we're the church, so that we're supposed to be moral. We're the church, so we're supposed to be united, and so we don't speak the truth to each other. We don't say, I am hurting, I need help. We don't say to one another, brother and sister, I love you, but you are in danger and in sin, because it might make things uncomfortable. Because it might shatter the mask that we have it together. Brothers and sisters, we don't have it together. That's why we're meeting here this morning. Because Jesus loved us and came and said, you are in sin, you are lost, let me rescue you. We are here because we need the good news weekly, really more than weekly, daily, moment by moment, to know that it is not what we do. It is not even the appearance of what we do that makes us acceptable, but it is Christ and his love for us, his sacrificial love that makes us acceptable. If we know we have the love of Christ and are accepted, then out of love for others, we can admit our failures and weaknesses that are hurting them. We can lovingly confront their sin that is hurting us, and yes, it will be messy. But it's actually a lot less dangerous than we think it will be. because the gospel of Jesus causes us to put Christ in his glory first. If we are putting Christ's glory first, then every little thing that annoys us is not something to confront, because it's not about us, but it's about the glory of Christ. What we choose to confront, how we choose to confront it, how we choose to receive it, will all be submitted to the glory of Christ and what matters to him, instead of how it shapes the way that we appear. It guards us against the attacks of legalism that try to tear others down and build us up by comparison. Instead, we confront what needs to be confronted and can let go of control to God, because he is the substance and the reality of what we worship, not the things that we do. There are many stories, survival stories, that mourn the reality that many who wander in the desert, many who are lost in the woods, perish looking for food and water that is right there available to them. If you know what vegetation to identify in the desert, you can find water, or even how to get it from condensation. If you're lost in the woods, what trees are available for you to eat and sustain yourselves? But people think, well, this is what food should look like. This is what water should look like. And so they look for the trappings of food and water. They look for the wrappers. They look for the normal packaging and miss the substance. Brothers and sisters, the substance of God has been shown to us in Jesus Christ. Let us not bypass his offering of himself to us because we want the packaging we expect of rules, of rituals, when the most important thing is Christ himself given to us. Religion, being religious, and legalism is vanity, brothers and sisters. But Jesus Christ is the living God who took on flesh and died for us, that we might know and be known by the living God. That is our hope this morning. Not this service, not these chairs, not our songs, but in what they redirect us to, Christ himself, who is our hope. Amen. Let's pray. Lord, save us from ourselves.